Life is unpredictable, but preparing for the unexpected shouldn't be. Take ownership of your life planning with Policy Genius to help your loved ones have a financial safety net in case something happens to you. They offer life insurance policies starting at just $276 a year for $1 million in coverage. Don't wait for life to make other plans. Protect your family today. Head to PolicyGenius.com. That's PolicyGenius.com.
Valspar Ultra starts at just $29.98 a gallon. So we've got you covered when your daughter wants to paint her room again, after last year's masterpiece of a unicorn mural.
Dad, please!
Or when you realize that maybe you went too hard on the greige.
I miss color.
Or when you were sure you wanted a home gym, but your elliptical is currently hanging your laundry.
What about a home office?
Shop everything you need for your next phase with Valspar. Available at Lowe's. Price varies by sheen.
Section 6 of A Strange Disappearance by Anna Catherine Green. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Mark Leader. Chapter 6, A Bit of Calico. It was about this time that I took up my residence in a sort of lodging house that occupied the opposite corner to that of Mr. Blake. My room, as I took pains to have it, overlooked the avenue, and from its windows I could easily watch the goings and comings of the gentleman whose movements were daily becoming of more and more interest to me. For set it down to caprice, and men are often as capricious as women, or account for it as you will, his restlessness at this period was truly remarkable. Not a day that he did not spend his time in walking the streets, and that not in his usual aimless, gentlemanly fashion, but eagerly and with an intent gaze that roamed here and there, like a bird seeking its prey. It would often be as late as 5 o'clock before he came in, and if, as now frequently happened, he did not have company to dinner, he was even known to start out again after 7 o'clock and go over the same ground as in the morning, looking with strained gaze that vainly endeavored to appear unconcerned into the faces of the women that he passed. I not unfrequently followed him at these times, as much for my own amusement as from any hope I had of coming upon anything that should aid me in the work before me. But when he suddenly changed his route of travel from a promenade in the fashionable thoroughfares of Broadway and 14th Street to a walk through Chatham Square and the dark, narrow streets of the East Side, I began to scent whom the prey might be that he was seeking, and putting every other consideration aside, regularly set myself to dog his steps, as only I, with my innumerable disguises, knew how to do. For 3 separate days I kept at his heels wherever he went, each day growing more and more astonished, if not to say hopeful, as I found myself treading the narrowest and most disreputable streets of the city, halting at the shops of pawnbrokers, peering into the back rooms of liquor shops, mixing with the crowds that infest the corner groceries at nightfall, and even slinking with hand on the trigger of the pistol I carried in my pocket up dark alleys where every door that swung noiselessly to and fro as we passed shut upon haunts of such villainy as only is known to us of the police, or to those good souls that for the sake of one whose example they follow lay aside their fears and sensitiveness to carry light into the dim pits of this wretched world. At first, I thought Mr. Blake might have some such reason for the peculiar course he took, but his indifference to all crowds where only men were collected, his silence where a word would have been well received, convinced me it was a woman he was seeking, and that with an intentness which blinded him to the commonest needs of the hour. I even saw him once, in his hurry and abstraction, step across the body of a child who'd fallen face downward on the stones, and that with an expression showing he was utterly unconscious of anything but an obstacle in his path. The strangest part of it all was that he seemed to have no fear. To be sure, he took pains to leave his watch at home, but with such a figure and carriage as he possessed, the absence of jewelry could never deceive the eye for a moment as to the fact of his being a man of wealth, and those he went among would do anything for money. Perhaps, like me, he carried a pistol, At all events, he shunned no spot where either poverty lay hid or deviltry reigned, his proud stern head bending to enter the lowest doors without a tremble of the haughty lips that remained compressed as by an iron force. Except when some poor forlorn creature with flaunting headgear and tremulous hands, attracted by his bearing, would hastily brush against him. When he would turn and look, perhaps speak, though what he said I always failed to catch. After which he would hurry on as if possessed by seven devils. The evenings of those 3 days were notable also. Two of them he spent in the manner I have described. The third, he went to the Windsor House, where the Countess de Mirac had taken rooms, going up to the lady's entrance and actually ringing the bell, only to start back and walk up and down on the opposite side of the way with his hands behind his back and his head bent, evidently deliberating as to whether he should or should not carry out his original intention of entering. The arrival of a carriage with the stately subject of his deliberations, who from her elaborate costume had seemingly been to some kettle drum or private reception, speedily put an end to his doubts. As the door opened to admit her, I saw him cast one look at her heavily draped person with its snowy opera cloak drawn tightly over the sweeping folds of her maize-colored silk, and shrink back with what sounded like a sigh of anger or distrust, and without waiting for the closing of a door upon her, turned toward home with a step that hesitated no longer. The fourth day, to my infinite chagrin, I was sick and could not go with him. All I could do was to wrap myself in blankets and sit in my window, from which I had the satisfaction of viewing him start, as I supposed, upon his usual course. The rest of the day was employed in a long, dull waiting for his return, only relieved by casual glimpses of Mrs. Daniel's troubled face as she appeared at one window or another of the old-fashioned mansion before me. She seemed, too, to be unusually restless, opening the windows and looking out with forlorn cranings of her neck as if she, too, were watching for her master. Indeed, I have no doubt from what I afterwards learned that she was in a state of constant suspense during these days. Her frequent appearance at the station house, where she in vain sought for some news of the girl in whose fate she was so absorbed, confirmed this. Only the day before I gave myself up to my unreserved espionage of Mr. Blake, she had had an interview with Mr. Grice, in which she had let fall her apprehensions that the girl was dead, and asked whether, if that were the case, the police would be likely to come into a knowledge of the fact. Upon being assured that if she had not been privately made way with, there was every chance in their favor, she'd grown a little calmer, but before going away had so far forgotten herself as to intimate that if some result was not reached before another fortnight had elapsed, she should take the matter into her own hands, and she did not say what she would do, but her looks were of a very menacing character. It was no wonder, then, that her countenance bore marks of the keenest anxiety as she trod the halls of that dim old mansion, with its dusky corners rich with bronzes and the glimmering shine of ancient brocades, breathing suggestions of loss and wrong, or bent her wrinkled forehead to gaze from the windows for the coming of one whose footsteps were ever delayed. She happened to be looking out when, after a longer stroll than usual, the master of the house returned. As he made his appearance at the corner, I saw her hurriedly withdraw her head and hide herself behind the curtain, from which position she watched him as with tired steps and somewhat dejected mien, he passed up the steps and entered the house. Not till the door closed upon him did she venture to issue forth, and with a hurried movement shut the blinds and disappear. This anxiety on her part redoubled mine, and thankful enough was I when on the next day I found myself well enough to renew my operations. To ferret out this mystery, if mystery it was, I still found myself forced to admit the possibility of there being none, had now become the one ambition of my life, and all because it was not only an unusually blind one, but of a nature that involved danger to my position as detective. I entered upon it with a zest rare even to me, who love my work and all it involves with an undivided passion. to equip myself then in a fresh disguise. And to join Mr. Blake shortly after he had left his own corner was anything but a hardship to me that bright winter morning, though I knew from past experience a long and wearisome walk was before me with nothing in all probability at the end but reiterated disappointment. But for once, the fates had willed it otherwise. Whether Mr. Blake, discouraged at the failure of his own attempts, whatever they were, felt less heart to prosecute them than usual, I cannot say. But we had scarcely entered upon the lower end of the Bowery before he suddenly turned with a look of disgust, and gazing hurriedly about him, hailed a Madison Avenue car that was rapidly approaching. I was at that moment on the other side of the way, but I hurried forward too, and signaled the same car. But just as I was on the point of entering it, I perceived Mr. Blake step hastily back, and with his eyes upon a girl that was hurrying past him with a basket on her arm, regain the sidewalk with a swiftness that argued his desire to stop her. Of course, I let the car pass me, though I did not dare approach him too closely after my late conspicuous attempt to enter it with him. But from my stand on the opposite curbstone, I saw him draw aside the girl, who from her garments might have been the daughter or wife of any one of the shiftless, drinking wretches lounging about on the four corners within my view. And after talking earnestly with her for a few moments, saunter at her side down Broome Street, still talking. Reckless at this sight of the consequences which might follow his detection of the part I was playing, I hasted after them when I was suddenly disconcerted by observing him hurriedly separate from the girl and turn towards me with intention, as if it were to regain the corner he'd left. Weighing in an instant the probable good to be obtained by following either party, I determined to leave Mr. Blake for one day to himself and turn my attention to the girl he had addressed, especially as she was tall and thin and bore herself with something like grace. Barely bestowing a glance upon him then as he passed, in a vain attempt to read the somber expression of his inscrutable face grown 5 years older in the last 5 days, I shuffled after the girl now flitting before me down Broome Street. As I did so, I noticed her dress to its minutest details, somewhat surprised to find how ragged and uncouth it was. That Mr. Blake should stop a girl wherever seen, clad in a black alpaca frock, a striped shawl and a Bowery hat trimmed with feathers, I could easily understand, but that this creature with her faded calico dress, dingy cape thrown carelessly over her head, and ragged basket should arrest his attention was a riddle to me. I hastened forward with intent to catch a glimpse of her countenance if possible, but she seemed to have acquired wings to her feet since her interview with Mr. Blake. Darting into a crowd of hooting urchins that were rushing from Center Street after a broken wagon and runaway horse, she sped from my sight with such rapidity, I soon saw that my only hope of overtaking her lay in running. I accordingly quickened my steps when those same hooting youngsters getting in the way of my feet, I tripped up and, well, I own I retired from that field baffled. Not entirely so, however, just as I was going down, I caught sight of the girl tearing away from a box of garbage on the curbstone, and when order having been restored, by which lofty statement I mean to say when your humble servant had regained his equilibrium, I awoke to the fact that she had effectually disappeared. I hurried to that box and succeeded in finding hanging to it a bit of rag easily recognized as a piece of the old calico frock of nameless color which I'd been following a moment before. Regarding it as the sole spoils of a very unsatisfactory day's work, I put it carefully away in my pocketbook where it lay till, but with all my zeal for compression, I must not anticipate. When I came home that afternoon, I found myself unexpectedly involved in a matter that, for the remainder of a day at least, prevented me from further attending to the affair I had in hand. The next morning, Mr. Blake did not start out as usual, and at noon I received intimation from Fanny that he was preparing to take a journey. Where, she could not inform me, nor when, though she thought it probable he would take an early train. Mrs. Daniels was feeling dreadfully, she informed me, and the house was like a grave. Greatly excited at this unexpected move on Mr. Blake's part, I went home and packed my valise with something of the spirit of her who once said, under somewhat different circumstances, I allow, "Whither thou goest, I will go." The truth was, I had traveled so far and learned so little that my professional pride was piqued. That expression of Mr. Grice still rankled, and nothing can soothe my injured spirit now but success. Accordingly, when Mr. Blake stepped up to the ticket office of the Hudson River Railroad next morning to buy a ticket for Putney, a small town in the northern part of Vermont, he found beside him a spruce young drummer, or what certainly appeared such, who by some strange coincidence wanted a ticket for the same place. The fact did not seem in the least to surprise him, nor did he cast me a look beyond the ordinary glance of one stranger at another. Indeed, Mr. Blake had no appearance of being a suspicious man, nor do I think at this time he had the remotest idea that he was either watched or followed, an ignorance of a truth which I took care to preserve by taking my seat in a different car from him, and not showing myself again during the whole ride from New York to Putney. End of section 6. Section 7 of A Strange Disappearance by Anna Catherine Green. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Mark Leader. Chapter 7. The House at Granby Cross Roads. Why Mr. Blake should take a journey at all at this time, and why of all places in the world he should choose such an insignificant town as Putney for his destination, was of course the mystery upon which I brooded during the entire distance. But when somewhere near 5 in the afternoon I stepped from the cars onto the platform at Putney Station, only to hear Mr. Blake making inquiries in regard to a certain stage running between that town and a still smaller village further east, I own I was not only surprised, but well nigh nonplussed, especially as he seemed greatly disappointed to hear that it only ran once a day and then for an earlier train in the morning. "You'll have to wait till tomorrow, I fear," said the ticket agent, "unless the landlord of the hotel down yonder can harness you up a team. There's a funeral out west today, and—" I did not wait to hear more, but hurried down to the hotel he had pointed out, and hunting up the landlord, inquired if for love or money he could get me any sort of a conveyance for Melville that afternoon. He assured me it would be impossible, the livery stable as well as his own being entirely empty. "Such a thing don't happen here once in 5 years," said he to me. "But the old codger who's dead, though a queer Dick, was a noted personage in these parts, and not a man, woman, or child who could find a horse, mule, or donkey but what availed himself of the privilege. Even the doctor's spavined mare was pressed into service, though she halts on one leg and stops to get her breath half a dozen times in going up one short hill. You'll have to wait for the stage, sir." "But I'm in a hurry," said I, as I saw Mr. Blake enter. "I have business in Melville tonight, and I'd pay anything in reason to get there." But the landlord only shook his head, and drawing back with the air of an abused man, I took up my stand in the doorway, where I could hear the same colloquy entered into with Mr. Blake, with the same unsatisfactory termination. He did not take it quite as calmly as I did, though he was of too reserved a nature to display much emotion over anything. The prospect of a long, tedious evening spent in a country hotel seemed almost unendurable to him, but he finally succumbed to the force of circumstances, as indeed he seemed obliged to do, and partaking of such refreshment as the rather poorly managed hotel afforded, retired without ceremony to his room, from which he did not emerge again till next morning. In all this, he had somehow managed not to give his name, and by means of some inquiries I succeeded in making that evening, I found his person was unknown in the town. By a little management, I secured the next room to his, by which arrangement I succeeded in passing a sleepless night, Mr. Blake spending most of the wee small hours in pacing the floor of his room, with an unremitting regularity that had anything but a soothing effect upon my nerves. Early the next morning, we took the stage, he sitting on the back seat and I in front with the driver. There were other passengers, but I noticed he never spoke to any of them, nor through all the long drive did he once look up from the corner where he had ensconced himself. It was 12 o'clock when he reached the end of the route, a small town of somewhat less than the usual pretensions of mountain villages. So insignificant, indeed, that I found it more and more difficult to imagine what the wealthy ex-congressman could find in such a spot as this to make amends for a journey of such length and discomfort. When, to my increasing wonder, I heard him give orders for a horse to be saddled and brought round to the inn door directly after dinner. This was a move I had not expected, and it threw me a little aback, for although I had thus far managed to hold myself so aloof from Mr. Blake, even while keeping him under my eye, that no suspicion of my interest in his movements had as yet been awakened. How could I thus, for the third time, follow his order with one precisely similar, without attracting an attention that would be fatal to my plans? Yet to let him ride off alone now would be to drop the trail at the very moment the scent became of importance. The landlord, a bustling, wiry little man, all nervousness and questions, unwittingly helped me at this crisis.
"Are you going on to Perry, sir?" inquired he of that gentleman. "I've been expecting a man along these 3 days bound for Perry."
"I'm that man," I broke in, stepping forward with some appearance of asperity, "and I hope you won't keep me waiting. A horse as soon as dinner is over, do you hear? I'm 2 days late now and won't stand any nonsense." And to escape the question sure to follow, I strode into the dining room with a half-fierce, half-sullen countenance that effectually precluded all advances. During the meal, I saw Mr. Blake's eye roam more than once towards my face, but I did not return his gaze or notice him in any way, hurrying through my dinner and mounting the first horse brought around, as if time were my only consideration. But once on the road, I took the first opportunity to draw rein and wait, suddenly remembering that I had not heard Mr. Blake give any intimation of a direction he intended taking. A few minutes revealed to me his elegant form well mounted and showing to perfection in his closely buttoned coat, slowly approaching up the road. Taking advantage of a rise in the ground, I lingered till he was almost upon me, when I cantered quickly on, fearing to arouse his apprehensions if I allowed him to pass me on a road so solitary as that which now stretched out before us, a move provocative of much embarrassment to me, as I dared not turn my head for the same reason, anxious as I was to keep him in sight. The roads dividing before me at length gave me my first opportunity to pause and look back. He was some 50 paces behind. Waiting till he came up, I bowed with a surly courtesy, I thought, in keeping with the character I had assumed, and asked if he knew which road led towards Perry, saying I'd come off in such haste I'd forgotten to inquire my way. He returned my bow, pointed towards the left-hand road, and saying, "I know this does not," calmly took it. Now, here was a dilemma. If in face of his curt response I proceeded to follow him, my hand was revealed at once. Yet the circumstances would admit of no other course. I determined to compromise matters by pretending to take the right-hand road till he was out of sight, when I would return and follow him swiftly upon the left. Accordingly, I reined my horse to the right and for some 15 minutes galloped slowly away towards the north. But another 15 saw me facing the west, and riding with a force and fury of which I had not thought the old mare they'd given me capable, till I put her to the test. It was not long before I saw my fine gentleman trotting in front of me up a long but gentle slope that rose in the distance, and slackening my own rein, I withdrew into the forest at the side of the road till he passed its summit and disappeared, when I again galloped forward. And thus we went on for an hour, Over the most uneven country I've ever traversed, he always won hill ahead. When suddenly, by what instinct I cannot determine, I felt myself approaching the end and hastening to the top of the ascent up which I was then laboring, looked down into the shallow valley spread out before me. What a sight met my eyes, as if I'd been intent on anything less practical than the movements of a solitary horseman below. Hills on hills piled about a verdant basin in whose depths nestled a scanty collection of houses, in number so small they could be told upon the fingers of the right hand, but which notwithstanding lent an indescribable aspect of comfort to this remote region of hill and forest. But the vision of Mr. Blake pausing halfway down the slope before me, examining, yes, examining a pistol which he held in his hand, soon put an end to all ideas of romance. Somewhat alarmed, I reined back, but his action had evidently no connection with me, for he did not once glance behind him, but kept his eye on the road, which I now observed took a short turn towards a house of so weird and ominous an appearance that I scarcely marveled at his precaution. Situated on a level tract of land at the crossing of three roads, its spacious front, rude and unpainted as it was, presented every appearance of an inn. From its moss-grown chimneys no smoke arose, nor could I detect any sign of life in its shutterless windows and closed doors, across which shivered the dark shadow of the one gaunt and aged pine that stood like a guard beside its tumbled-down porch. Mr. Blake seemed to have been struck by the same fact concerning its loneliness, for hurriedly replacing his pistol in his breast pocket, he rode slowly forward. I instantly conceived the plan of striking across the belt of underbrush that separated me from this old dwelling, and by taking my stand opposite its front, intercept a view of Mr. Blake as he approached. Hastily dismounting, therefore, I led my horse into the bushes and tied her to a tree, proceeding to carry out my plan on foot. I was so far successful as to arrive at the further edge of the wood, which was thick enough to conceal my presence, without being too dense to obstruct my vision, just as Mr. Blake passed on his way to his solitary dwelling. He was looking very anxious, but determined. Turning my eyes from him, I took another glance at the house, which by this movement I had brought directly before me. It was even more deserted-looking than I had thought. Its unpainted front with its double row of blank windows meeting your gaze without a response, while the huge old pine, with half its limbs dismantled of foliage, rattled its old bones against its sides and moaned in its aged fashion like the solitary retainer of a dead race. I own I felt the cold shivers creep down my back as that creaking sound struck my ears, though as the day was chill with an east wind, I dare say it was more the effect of my sudden cessation from exercise than of any superstitious awe I felt. Mr. Blake seemed to labor under no such impressions. Riding up to the front door, he knocked without dismounting on its dismal panels with his riding whip. No response was heard. Knitting his brows impatiently, he tried the latch. The door was locked. Hastily running his eye over the face of the building, he drew rein and proceeded to ride around the house, which he could easily do owing to the absence of every obstruction in the way of fence or shrubbery. Finding no means of entrance, he returned again to the front door, which he shook with an impatient hand that, however, produced no impression upon the trusty lock. And recognizing, doubtless, the futility of his endeavors, he drew back, and merely pausing to give one other look at its deserted front, turned his horse's head, and to my great amazement proceeded with somber mien and clouded brow to retake the road to Melville. This old inn or decayed homestead was then the object of his lengthened and tedious journey, this ancient house rotting away among the bleak hills of Vermont, the bourne towards which his steps had been tending for these past 2 days. I could not understand it. Rapidly emerging from the spot where I had secreted myself, I in my turn made a circuit of the house, if happily I should discover some loophole of entrance which had escaped his attention.
but every door and window was securely barred, and I was about to follow his example and leave the spot, when I saw two or three children advancing towards me down the crossroads, gaily swinging their school books. I noticed they hesitated and huddled together as they approached and saw me, but not heeding this, I accosted them with a pleasant word or so. Then, pointing over my shoulder to the house behind, asked who lived there. Instantly, their already pale faces grew paler. "Why," cried one, a boy, "don't you know? That's where the two wicked men lived who stole the money out of the Rutland Bank. They were put in prison, but they got away and..." Here the other, a little girl, plucked him by the sleeve with such a fright that he himself took alarm, and just giving me one quick stare out of his wide eyes, grasped his companion by the hand and took to his heels. As for myself, I stood rooted to the ground in my astonishment. This blank, sleepy old house, the home of notorious Schoenmakers, after whom half of the detectives of the country were searching, I could scarcely credit my own ears. True, I now remembered they'd come from these parts. Still, turning round, I eyed the house once more. How altered it looked to me! What a murderous aspect it wore, and how dismally secret were the tight-shut windows and closely fastened doors, on one of which a rude cross scrawled in red chalk met the eye with a mysterious significance. Even the old pine had acquired the villainous air of the uncanny repositor of secrets too dreadful to reveal, as it groaned and murmured to itself in the keen east wind. Dark deeds and foul wrong seemed written all over the fearful place, from the long strings of black moss that clung to the worm-eaten eaves to the worn stone with its great blotch of something. Could it have been blood? That served as a threshold to the door. Suddenly, with the quickness of lightning, the thought flashed across me, what could Mr. Blake, the aristocratic representative of New York's oldest family, have wanted in this nest of infamy? What errand of hope, fear, despair, avarice, or revenge could have brought this superior gentleman, with his refined tastes and proudly reticent manners, so many miles from home, to the forsaken den of a brace of hardy villains whose name for 2 years now had stood as the type of all that was bold, bad, and lawless, and for whom during the last 6 weeks the prison had yawned and the gallows hungered? Contemplation brought no reply, and shocked at my own thoughts, I put the question by for steadier brains than mine, and instead of trying further to solve it, cast about how I was to gain entrance into this deserted building. For to enter it I was more than ever determined, now that I'd heard to whom it had once belonged. Examining with a glance the several roads that branched off in every direction from where I stood, I found them all equally deserted. Even the school children had disappeared in some one of the 4 or 5 houses scattered in the remote distance. If I was willing to enter upon any daring exploit, there was no one to observe or interrupt. I resolved to make the attempt with which my mind was full. This was to climb the old tree and from one of the 2 or 3 branches that brushed against the house, gain entrance at an open garret window that stared at me from amid the pine's dark needles. Taking off my coat with a sigh over the immaculate condition of my new cashmere trousers, I bent my energies to the task. A difficult one, you'll say, for a city lad, but thanks to fortune I was not brought up in New York and know how to climb trees with the best. With little more than a scratch or so, I reached the window of which I've spoken, and after a moment spent in regaining my breath, gave one spring and accomplished my purpose. I alighted upon a heap of broken glass in a large bare room. An ominous chill at once struck to my heart. Though I am anything but a sensitive man as far as physical impressions are concerned, there was something in the hollow echo that arose from the 4 blank walls about me as my feet alighted on that rough, uncarpeted floor that struck a vague chill through my blood and I actually hesitated for the moment whether to pursue the investigations I had promised myself or beat a hasty retreat. A glance at the huge distorted limbs swaying across the square of the open window decided me. It was easy to enter by means of that unsteady support, but it would be extremely unsafe to venture forth in that way. If I prized life and limb, I must seek some other method of egress. I at once put my apprehensions in my pocket and entered upon my self-imposed task. A single glance was sufficient to exhaust the resources of the empty garret in which I found myself. Two or three old chairs piled in one corner, a rusty stove or so, a heap of tattered and decaying clothing were all that met my gaze. Taking my way then at once to the ladder, whose narrow ends projecting above a hole in the garret floor, seemed to prefer the means of reaching the rooms below. I proceeded to descend into what, to my excited imagination, looked like a gulf of darkness. It proved, however, to be nothing more nor less than an unlighted hall of small dimensions, with a staircase at one end and a door at the other, which, upon opening, I found myself in a large square room, whose immense four-post bedstead, entirely denuded of its usual accompaniment of bed and bolster, at once struck my eye and for a moment held it enchained. There were other articles in the room, a disused bureau, a rocking chair, even a table, but nothing had such a ghostly look as that antique bedstead with its curtains of calico tied back over its naked framework, like rags draped from the bare bones of a skeleton. Passing hurriedly by, I tried a closet door or so, finding little, however, to reward my search. And eager to be done with what was every moment becoming more and more drearisome, I hastened across the floor to the front of the house, where I found another hall and a row of rooms that, while not entirely stripped of furniture, were yet sufficiently barren to offer little encouragement to my curiosity. One only, a small but not uncomfortable apartment, showed any signs of having been occupied within a reasonable length of time. And as I paused before its hastily spread bed, thrown together as only a man would do it, and wondering why the room was so dark, looked up and saw that the window was entirely covered by an old shawl and a couple of heavy coats that had been hastily nailed across it, I own I felt my hand go to my breast pocket, almost as if I expected to see the wild faces of a dreaded Schoenmaker start up all aglare from one of the dim corners before me. Rushing to the window, I tore down with one sweep of my arm both coat and shawl, and with a start discovered that the window still possessed its draperies in the shape of a pair of discolored and tattered curtains tied with ribbons that must once have been brilliant and cheery of color. Nor was this the only sign in the room of a bygone presence that had possessed a taste for something beyond the mere necessities of life. On the grim, coarsely papered wall hung more than one picture, cut from pictorial newspapers to be sure, but each and every one, if I may be called the judge of such matters, possessing some quality of expression to commend it to a certain order of taste. They were all strong pictures, vivid faces of men and women in daring positions, a hunter holding back a jaguar from his throat, a soldier protecting his comrade from the stroke, and most striking of all, a woman, lissome as she was powerful, starting aghast and horror-stricken from what? I could not tell. A rough hand had stripped the remainder of the picture from the wall. A bit of candle and a half sheet of newspaper lay on the floor. I picked up the paper. It was a Rutland Herald and bore the date of 2 days before. As I read, I realized what I had done. If these daring robbers were not at this very moment in the house, they had been there, and that within 2 or 3 days. The broken panes of glass in the garret above were now explained. I was not the first one who had climbed that creaking pine tree this fall. Something like a sensible dread of a very possible danger now seized hold of me. If I'd stumbled upon these strangely subtle, yet devilishly bold creatures in their secret lair, the pistol I carried was not going to save me. Shut in like a fox in a hole, I had little to hope for if they once made their appearance at the stairhead or came upon me from any of the dim halls of the crazy old dwelling, which I now began to find altogether too large for my comfort. Stealing cautiously forth from the room in which I had found so much to disconcert me, I crept towards the front staircase and listened. All was deathly quiet. The old pine tree moaned and twisted without, and from time to time the wind came sweeping down the chimney with an unearthly shrieking sound that was weirdly in keeping with the place. But within and below all was still as the tomb, and though in no ways reassured, I determined to descend and have the suspense over at once. I did so, pistol in hand and ears stretched to their utmost to catch the slightest rustle, but no sound came to disturb me, nor did I meet on this lower floor the sign of any other presence in the house but my own. Passing hastily through what appeared to be a sort of rude parlor, I stepped into the kitchen and tried one of the windows. Finding I could easily lift it from the inside, I drew my breath with ease for the first time since I had alighted among the broken glass above, and turning back, deliberately opened the door of the kitchen stove and looked in. As I half expected, I found a pile of partly charred rags, showing where the wretches had burned their prison clothing, and proceeding further, picked up from the ashes a ring, which, whether or not they were conscious of having attempted to destroy in this way, I cannot say, but which I thankfully put in my pocket against the day it might be required as proof. Discerning nothing more in that quarter inviting interest, I asked myself if I had nerve to descend into the cellar, finally concluding that that was more than could be expected from any man in my position. I gave one look of farewell to the damp and desolate walls about me, then with a breath of relief jumped from the kitchen window again into the light and air of day. As I did so, I could swear I heard a door within that old house swing on its hinges and softly close. With a thrill, I recognized the fact that it came from the cellar. My thoughts on the road back to Melville were many and conflicting. Chief above them all, however, rose the comfortable conclusion that in the pursuit of one mysterious affair, I had stumbled, as is often the case, upon the clue to another of yet greater importance, and by so doing got a start that might yet redound greatly to my advantage. For the reward offered for the recapture of the Schoenmakers was large, and the possibility of my being the one to put the authorities upon their track certainly appeared after this day's developments open at least to a very reasonable hope. At all events, I determined not to let the grass grow under my feet till I had informed the superintendent of what I had seen and heard that day in the old haunt of these two escaped convicts. Arrived at the public house in Melville, and learning that Mr. Blake had safely returned there an hour before, I drew the landlord to one side and asked what he could tell me about that old house of the two noted robbers Schoenmaker. I'd passed on my way back among the hills.
"Well, now," replied he, "this is curious. Here I've just been answering the gentleman upstairs a heap of questions concerning that selfsame old place, and now you come along with another batch of them, just as if that rickety old den was the only spot of interest we had in these parts."
"Perhaps that may be the truth," I laughed. "Just now, when the papers are full of these rogues, anything concerning them must be of superior interest, of course." And I pressed him again to give me a history of the house and the two thieves who had inhabited it.
"Well," drawled he, "'tain't much we know about them, yet after all it may be a trifle too much for their neck some day. Time was when nobody thought especial ill of them beyond a suspicion or so of their being somewhat mean about money. That was when they kept an inn there. But when the robbery of the Rutland Bank was so clearly traced to them, more than one man about here started up and said as how they'd always suspected them Schoenmakers of being villains, and even hinted at something worse than robbery. But nothing beyond that one rascality has yet been proved against them, and for that they were sent to jail for 20 years, as you know. 2 months ago they escaped, and that's the last known of them. A precious set, too, they are, the father being only so much the greater rogue than the son, as he is years older.
And the inn? When was that closed?
Just after their arrest.
Hasn't it been open since?
Only once, when a brace of detectives came up from Troy to investigate, as they called it.
Who has the key?
Oh, that's more than I can tell you.
I dared not ask how my questions differed from those of Mr. Blake, nor indeed touch upon that point in any way. I was chiefly anxious now to return to New York without delay. So paying my bill, I thanked the landlord, and without waiting for the stage, remounted my horse and proceeded at once to Putney, where I was fortunate enough to catch the evening train. By 5 o'clock next morning, I was in New York, where I proceeded to carry out my program by hastening at once to headquarters and reporting my suspicions regarding the whereabouts of the Schoenmakers. The information was received with interest, and I had the satisfaction of seeing two men dispatched north that very day with orders to procure the arrest of the two notable villains were ever found.
End of Section 7. Section 8 of A Strange Disappearance by Anna Catherine Green. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Mark Leader. Chapter 8. A Word Overheard.
That evening I had a talk with Fanny over the area gate. She came out when she saw me approach, with eyes staring and her whole form in a flutter.
"Oh," she cried, "such things I've heard this day."
"Well," said I, "what? Let me hear too." She put her hand on her heart.
"I never was so frightened," whispered she. "I thought I should have fainted right away to hear that elegant lady use such a word as crime."
"What elegant lady?" interrupted I. "Don't begin in the middle of your story. That's a good girl. I want to hear it all."
"Well," said she, calming down a little, "Mrs. Daniels had a visitor today, a lady. She was dressed..."
"Oh, now," interrupted I for the second time, "you can leave that out. Tell me what her name was, and let the folderols go."
"Her name?"
exclaimed the girl with some sharpness. "How should I know her name? She didn't come to see me."
"How did she look, then? You saw her, I suppose?" "And wasn't that what I was telling you when you stopped me? She looked like a queen, that she did, as grand a lady as ever I see, in her velvet dress sweeping over the floor, and her diamonds as big as..."
"Was she a dark woman?" I asked.
"Her hair was black, and so were her eyes, if that is what you mean."
"And was she very tall and proud-looking?" The girl nodded.
"You know her?" whispered she.
"No," said I, "not exactly. But I think I can tell you who she is." "And so she called today on Mrs. Daniels, did she?"
"Yes, but I guess she knew Master would be home before she got away."
"Come," said I, "tell me all about it. I'm getting impatient."
"And ain't I telling you," said she. "It was about 3 o'clock this afternoon, the time I go upstairs to dress. So I just hangs about in the hall a bit, near the parlor door, and I hear her gossiping with Mrs. Daniels almost as if she was an old friend, and Mrs. Daniels answering her mighty stiffly and as if she wasn't glad to see her at all. But the lady didn't seem to mind, but went on talking as sweet as honey, and when they came out, you would have thought she loved the old woman like a sister to see her look into her face and say something about knowing how busy she was, but that it would give her so much pleasure if she'd come some day to see her and talk over old times. But Mrs. Daniels wasn't pleased a bit, and showed plain enough she didn't like the lady, fine as she was in her ways. She was going to answer her, too, but just then the front door opened, and Mr. Blake, with his satchel in his hand, came into the house. And how he did start, to be sure, when he saw them, though he tried to say something perlite, which he didn't seem to take to at all, for after muttering something about not expecting to see him, she put her hand on the knob and was going right out. But he stopped her, and they went into the parlor together, while Mrs. Daniels stood staring after them like one mad, her hand held out with the bag and umbrella in it, stiff as a statue in the Central Park. She didn't stand so long, though, but came running down the hall as if she was bewitched. I was dreadful flustered, for though I was hid behind the wall that juts out there by the back stairs, I was afraid she would see me and shame me before Mr. Blake. But she passed right by and never looked up. There is something dreadful mysterious in this, thought I, and I just made up my mind to stay where I was till Mr. Blake and the lady should come out again from the parlor. I didn't have to wait very long. In a few minutes the door opened and they stepped out, he ahead and she coming after. I thought this was queer. He's always so dreadful polite in his ways. But I thought it was a deal queerer when I saw him go up the front stairs, she hurrying after, looking, I cannot tell you how, but awful troubled and anxious, I should say. They went into that room of his he calls his studio, and though I knew it might cost me my place if I was found out, I couldn't help following and listening at the keyhole. And what did you hear? I asked, for she paused to take breath. Well, the first thing I heard was a cry of pleasure from her, and the words, you keep that always before you. You cannot dislike me then as much as you pretend. I don't know what she meant nor what he did, but he stepped across the room and I heard a cry out this time as if she was hurt as well as awful surprised. And he talked and talked, and I couldn't catch a word he spoke so low. And by she sobbed just a little, and I got scared, and I would have run away, but she cried out with a kind of shriek, oh, don't say any more, to think that crime should come into our family, the proudest in the land. How could you, Holman, how could you? Yes, the girl went on, flushing in her excitement till she was as red as the cherry ribbons in her cap. Those were the very words she used. To think that crime should come into our family, the proudest one in the land. And she called him by his first name and asked him how he could do it. And what did Mr. Blake say, returned I, a little taken back myself at this result of my efforts with Fanny. Oh, I didn't wait to hear. I didn't wait for anything. If folks was going to talk about such things as that, I thought I'd better be anywhere than listening at the keyhole. I went right upstairs, I can tell you. And whom have you told of what you heard in the half-dozen hours that have gone by? Nobody. How could you think so mean of me when I promised? And it's not necessary to go any further into this portion of the interview. The Countess de Mirac possessed to its fullest extent the present fine lady's taste for bric-a-brac. So much I had learned in my inquiries concerning her. Remembering this, I took the bold resolution of profiting by this weakness of hers to gain admission to her presence, she being the only one sharing Mr. Blake's mysterious secret. Borrowing a valuable antique from a friend of mine at that time in the business, I made my appearance the very next day at her apartments, and sending in an urgent request to see Madame by the trim negress who answered my summons, waited in some doubt for her reply. It came all too soon. Madame was ill and could see no one. I was not, however, to be baffled by one rebuff. Handing the basket I held to the girl, I urged her to take it in and show her mistress what it contained, saying it was a rare article which might never again come her way. The girl complied, though with a doubtful shake of the head which was anything but encouraging. Her incredulity, however, must have been speedily rebuked, for she almost immediately returned without the basket, saying Madame would see me. My first thoughts upon entering the grand lady's presence was that the girl had been mistaken, for I found the Countess walking the floor in an abstracted way, drawing a letter she had evidently but just completed, but shaking it to and fro with an unsteady hand. The plaque I had brought lying neglected on the table. But at sight of my respectful form standing with bent head in the doorway, she hurriedly thrust the letter into a book and took up the plaque.
As she did so, I marked her well and almost started a change I observed in her since that evening at the academy. It was not only that she was dressed in some sort of loose déshabille that was in eminent contrast to the sweeping silks and satins in which I had hitherto beheld her adorned, or that she was laboring under some physical disability that robbed her dark cheek of the bloom that was its chiefest charm. The change I observed went deeper than that. It was more as if a light had been extinguished in her countenance. It was the same woman I'd beheld standing like a glowing column of will and strength before the melancholy form of Mr. Blake, but with the will and strength gone, and with them all the glow. She no longer hopes, thought I, and already felt repaid for my trouble. "This is a very pretty article you've brought me," said she, with something of the unrestrained love of art which she undoubtedly possessed, showing itself through all her languor. "Where did it come from, and what recommendations have you to prove it is an honest sale you offer me?" "None," returned I, ignoring with a reassuring smile the first question, "except that I should not be afraid if all the police in New York knew that I was here with this fine plaque for sale." She gave a shrug of her proud shoulder that bespoke the French countess, and softly ran her finger round the edge of the plaque. "I don't need anything more of this kind," she said languidly. "Besides," and she set it down with a fretful air, "I'm in no mood to buy this afternoon." Then, shortly, "What do you ask for it?" I named a fabulous price. She started and cast me a keen glance. "You had better take it to someone else. I have no money to throw away." With a hesitating hand, I lifted the plaque towards the basket. "I would very much like to sell it to you," said I. "Perhaps..." Just then a lady's fluttering voice rose from the room beyond, inquiring for the countess, and hurriedly taking the plaque from my hand with an impulsive, "Oh, there's Amy," she passed into the adjoining apartment, leaving the door open behind her. I saw a quick interchange of greetings between her and a fashionably dressed lady. Then they withdrew to one side with the ornament I'd brought, evidently consulting in regard to its merits. Now was my time. The book in which she had placed the letter she had been writing lay on the table right before me, not 2 inches from my hand. I had only to throw back the cover and my curiosity would be satisfied. Taking advantage of a moment when their backs were both turned, I pressed open the book with a careful hand, and with one eye on them and one on the sheet before me, managed to read these words. "My dearest Cecilia, I've tried in vain to match the sample you sent me at Stewart's, Arnold's, and McCreary's. If you still insist upon making up a dress in the way you propose, I will see what Madame Dudevant can do for us, but I cannot but advise you to alter your plans and make the darker shade of velvet do. I went to the Carey reception last night and met Lulu Chittenden. She has actually grown old, but was as lively as ever. She created a great stir in Paris when she was there. But a husband who comes home 2 o'clock in the morning with bleared eyes and empty pockets is not conducive to the preservation of a woman's beauty. How she manages to retain her spirits, I cannot imagine. You ask me news of Cousin Holman. I meet him occasionally, and he looks well, but has grown into the most somber man you ever saw. In regard to certain hopes of which you have sometimes made mention, let me assure you, they are no longer practicable. He has done what..." Here the conversation ceased in the other room. The countess made a movement of advance, and I closed the book with an inward groan over my ill luck. "It's very pretty," she said with a weary air, "but as I remarked before, I am not in the buying mood. If you'll take half you mention, I may consider the subject, but..." "Pardon me, madame," I interrupted, being in no wise anxious to leave the plaque behind me. "I have been considering the matter, and I hold to my original price. Mr. Blake of Second Avenue may give it to me if you do not." "Mr. Blake?" She eyed me suspiciously. do you sell to him?
I sell to anyone I can, replied I, and as he has an artist's eye for such things.
Her brows knitted, and she turned away.
I do not want it, said she. Sell it to whom you please.
I took up the plaque and left the room.
End of section 8. Section 9 of A Strange Disappearance by Anna Katharine Green. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Mark Leader. Chapter 9, A Few Golden Hairs. When a few days from that I made my appearance before Mr. Grice, it was to find him looking somewhat sober.
Those Schoenmakers, said he, are making a deal of trouble. It seems they escaped the fellows up north and are now somewhere in this city, but where?
An expressive gesture finished the sentence.
Is that so? Exclaimed I. Then we are sure to nab them. Given time and a pair of low, restless German thieves, I'll wager anything our hands will be upon them before the month is over. I only hope when we do come across them, it will not be to find their betters too much mixed up with their devilish practices. And I related to him what Fanny had told me a few evenings before.
The coil is tightening, said he. What the end will be, I don't know.
Crime, said she. I wish I knew in what blind hole of the earth that girl we are after lies hidden. And as if in answer to this wish, the door opened and one of our men came in with a letter in his hand.
Ha! Exclaimed Mr. Grice after he'd perused it. Look at that.
I took the letter from his hand and read. The dead body of a girl such as you describe was found in the East River off 50th Street this morning. From appearance, has been dead some time. Have telegraphed to police headquarters for orders. Should you wish to see the body before it is removed to the morgue or otherwise disturbed, please hasten to Pier 48 ER.
Graham.
Come, said I, let's go and see for ourselves, if it should be the one. The dinner party proposed by Mr. Blake for tonight may have its interruptions, he remarked. I do not wish to make my story any longer than is necessary, but I must say that when, in an hour or so later, I stood with Mr. Grice before the unconscious form of that poor drowned girl, I felt an unusual degree of awe stealing over me. There was so much mystery connected with this affair, and the parties implicated were of such standing and repute. I almost dreaded to see the covering removed from her face, lest I should behold what? I could not have told if I tried.
A trim-made body enough,
cried the official in charge, as Mr. Grice lifted an end of the cloth that enveloped her and threw it back.
Pity the features that are not better preserved.
No need for us to see the features, exclaimed I, pointing to the locks of golden red hair that hung in tangled masses about her. The hair is enough. She's not the one. And I turned aside, asking myself if it was relief I felt. To my surprise, Mr. Grice did not follow. Tall, thin, white face, black eyes, I heard him whisper to himself. It's a pity the features are not better preserved. But, said I, taking him by the arm, Fanny spoke particularly of her hair being black, while this girl's... Good heavens, I suddenly ejaculated as I looked again at the prostrate form before me. Yellow hair or black, this is the girl I saw him speaking to that day in Broome Street. I remember her clothes, if nothing more. And opening my pocketbook, I took out the morsel of cloth I'd plucked that day from the ash barrel, lifted up the discolored rags that hung about the body, and compared the two. The pattern, texture, and color were the same.
Well, said Mr. Grice, pointing to certain contusions, like marks from the blow of some heavy instrument on the head and bared arms of the girl before us.
He will have to answer me one question anyhow, and that is who this poor creature is who lies here the victim of treachery or despair.
and turning to the official, he asked if there were any other signs of violence on the body. The answer came deliberately.
Yes, she's evidently been battered to death.
Mr. Rice's lips closed with grim decision.
A most brutal murder, said he,
and lifting up the cloth with a hand that visibly trembled, he softly covered her face.
Well, said I, as we slowly paced back up the pier, there's one thing certain, she's not the one who disappeared from Mr. Blake's house.
I'm not so sure of that.
How, said I? You believed Fanny lied when she gave that description of the missing girl upon which we've gone till now?
Mr. Grice smiled, and turning back, beckoned to the official behind us.
Let me have that description, said he, which I distributed among the harbor police some days ago for the identification of a certain corpse I was on the lookout for.
The man opened his coat and drew out a printed paper, which at Mr. Grice's word he put into my hand. It ran as follows. Look out for the body of a young girl, tall, well-shaped but thin, a fair complexion and golden hair of a peculiarly bright and beautiful color, and when found, acquaint me at once. G.
I don't understand, began I.
But Mr. Grice, tapping me on the arm, said in his most deliberate tones, next time you examine a room in which anything of a mysterious nature has occurred, look under the bureau. If you find a comb there with several long golden hairs tangled in it, be very sure before you draw any definite conclusions that your fannies know what they're talking about when they declare the girl who used that comb had black hair on her head.
End of section 9.